How are you finding this project then? Working on it?
Yeah, it's there's no easy answer to that. It's very intense, and it's like affecting me in all kinds of ways, and it's stirring up a lot of stuff. And I was saying to my wife yesterday that there's a weird sort of tension in that. I feel like this material is very potentially very controversial, and it could have impact in the world and people. And I'm at the center of it, and here at the center I'm like feeling very kind of raw and uncertain about myself and lacking in confidence, and partly because this material really is challenging me as well. It's like really throwing things into question for me, so it's like I'm putting myself out there in a way that feels more risky than ever, simultaneously to feeling more vulnerable than before, like more like withdrawing and just hiding away kind of feeling.
Yeah. But although I think part of the essay is because you kind of talk about your current feelings, you know, as you're going through the different chapters, I think it may offset some criticisms because you're not sort of, being like a dictator or being empirical with saying this is this.
Mm-hmm.
I think it reads quite sympathetically.
Yeah, that's my hope, and sort of partly conscious intention wasn't to deflect criticism so much, but it's to make it more sensitive and in the context of Strieber and how the sort of impact it could have on him. I wanted to be sure that this was done as sensitively as humanly possible, and the natural way to ensure that was to put myself under the microscope at the same time, so that I would be empathically tuning to the whole process as much as possible.
I did wonder with the previous Whitley essay, if it was Whitley's own sensitivity that had caused, like, you know, the mother stranglers to be all, you know, on the offensive.
Right.
That Whitley is that sensitive that I don't know, the mother stranglers were like Whitley's intelligent limbs, in a way.
Right. Guardians.
Yeah. That's how it came across to me, reading it. It seemed very, I don't know, a lot of it seemed very protective.
Well, I think he does communicate that. He communicates that sort of victim thing, and then he's outraged, and that any sort of criticism of him is a personal attack. That whole energy, A, makes people reluctant to criticize him and challenge him, so it's very effective, and B, it causes other people to rally around him and want to protect him and defend him.
Yeah. And I found it really strange, just because I thought what you wrote was very reasonable, and I thought it also made Whitley look interesting. And look at, you know, I previously wasn't really interested in Whitley, and it got me interested in him. So, yeah, I thought he was quite sympathetic, so I was really sort of, God, what's happening here? And when all that came about.
Curious about, to go back maybe to the bots that you spoke to.
Yeah.
This is a free service, anyone can do it?
Yeah. If you go on Wikipedia and just type in the Turing test, Turing spelled T-U-R-I-N-G.
Yeah.
And it'll give you a list of these bots, and it'll give you some links, and you can just have a look.
Yeah, I know about Turing. I mean, he's practically a god to in certain circles. And the, you know, Philip K. Dick, Do Androids Dream of Electric Sleep, the weren't called replicants in the book, but anyway, the Blade Runner, the test for the replicants, is somewhat based on Turing. I think that this idea is kind of symptomatic of the over-subjective and therefore delusional sort of reasoning or logic behind a lot of these systems or ideas, because his idea is basically if an intelligent machine or an intelligent program, artificial intelligent program, can fool a human into thinking that it is self-aware, then it is. Right? More or less, that's it, isn't it?
Yeah, pretty much.
So, I mean, what kind of logic is that? I mean, I could see, okay, fair enough, we don't know. You have to admit then we don't know. Maybe it is self-aware, but it certainly doesn't mean it is self-aware just because... And anyway, you know, which human are we going to talk about? Like, if you can fool a five-year-old, is that the same as fooling Einstein? Not really. So it just seems a very odd sort of hypothesis to me, like many of these computer geniuses' hypotheses. They seem somewhat disconnected from...
Yeah, it does, and I also think that, I mean, it's bound, you know, if they do perfect AI, it's bound to be used for some dodgy reasons, whether it's, you know, sex robots or something like that,
mm-hmm.
or, you know, like in AI, where they have the flesh fare, and they just have these robots there, so they can basically massacre them for the crowd.
Mm-hmm.
And so I think the worry is that whether the AI is self-aware or not, if we judge it as not being self-aware, if we, you know, smash the face in of a robot, it affects us.
Yeah, right.
Anyway, even though that's not a real thing.
Absolutely.
Yeah. So, I don't know. It's worrying.
Well, it does seem like it's, and this is my point in chapter 4 about Kurzweil, the infinite infant, that it seems to be extending infant patterns, the infant desire to have one's world be one's playground, which ideally it is for an infant. I mean, it's about neoteny, that like, intelligence really flourishes when we're able to grow up in a safe environment where we can play, and the longer we can be in that environment that's safe, that's protective, that's nurturing, the longer we can engage that play instinct, the more our intelligence will grow. So for an infant to experience his world as a playground is very healthy, and it may even be that the supreme kind of health would be that we never not that we stay at an infant stage, but we never lose that ability to experience our environment as a playground and to engage with reality in the spirit and the form in the mood of play. I think that would be the goal, and that's what enlightenment is, if you can return to that childlike state where you're engaged in play the whole time. But in most cases this doesn't happen, that we're you know, our intelligence or our development is arrested very early on because we're not in a safe enough environment to continue engaging in that playful way of exploring and testing boundaries and everything that real intelligence requires to grow. And so we get stuck in that infant state at some level. We grow up intellectually and physically, but at a deeper level, a deeper spiritual and emotional level, we don't. We're stuck in that infant stage, and then we're forever trying to recreate the environment of play that we didn't get. And so then the transhumanist thing and what you're describing, I mean, all of these things, they do seem to, underneath them, there seems to be this infantile desire to create our own playground, a virtual reality in which we can satisfy all of our desires.
Yeah, and I think to some extent that's what's happened. I mean, with Facebook, for instance, yeah, you can completely sort of basically edit your social life, and you know, and but to what extent do you think that's a bad thing?
Well, I think it's just the it's not good or bad. It's real and unreal, and I think that that is somewhere, maybe not in this world, but somewhere there is an empirical standard there of real and unreal, unlike, you know, what these new age religions or spiritual what have yous would have us believe, that we create our own reality and therefore there is only subjective reality. Well, I think, I mean, it's a tough one because I think it's kind of a tautology that reality is subjective, because if there isn't a subject, right, there's nothing to perceive. That's my take on it. Anyway, there can be no objective reality, but objective in the sense of it being empirical, like it being, it existing outside of the perception of it.
Yeah.
It can't, it has to be perceived to be, but, well, see, I just end up chasing my tail here, but I think that there is there's a reality behind reality, and I think that what we do with the intellect and what we do with the ego and what human beings are doing is creating maps and interpretation systems that are supposed to be based on reality, and that the aim is to actually lead us to ultimate reality. But it's like the replication thing. Like we've made copies of copies of copies. The ancient wisdom's been passed down through, you know, millennia of Chinese whispers, and so what we've ended up with is, we're now making maps that have almost no reference to reality. They're not maps that can lead us to the bedrock. They're not systems that are actually going to get to the real ground. They've become the opposite of that. They've become ways to actually live on the map. We want to create maps that are so elaborate that we don't have to use them to find reality at all. They will replace reality.
Okay.
So, is that good or bad? Well, it's not real, that's all I can say. It's not actually, it's not real. You can't replace reality, because that would then, you would then have to redefine what you mean by reality.
And well, yeah, it seems to be in a process of being redefined anyway. I mean, for me, I'm more looking at it on the idea of reality tunnels. You know, everyone's got their own reality tunnel, but there's like a hub reality that contains all these reality tunnels.
Okay.
And for me, it's more the danger that people can be so addicted to their own reality tunnels that kind of the hub reality goes ignored, or forgotten about, and so yeah. So that then you get the situation where, you know, the hub reality comes crashing through the reality tunnel.
Yes. Well, I mean, this. I was thinking while we took that break, I was seeing a few notes that the reality coming crashing through in this apocalyptic fashion, which I think in its purest sense is kind of a return of the repressed, the stirring of the id, the the unconscious matter coming into consciousness. So it's a psychic phenomenon, takes place in the psyche, but you know, because the nature of our the way that we experience reality is that we have to turn everything into something familiar. Like we've got this system, we've got this grid, this structure that we've built on top of reality, and it seems like there's two choices. Either we let reality come in, sort of trickle in, and then we will find a way to incorporate it into those structures so we don't even really notice it, but they prop up the structures and we, our structures become, seem to become more and more real. Or the reality just comes crashing through and destroys the structures completely and we have a schizophrenic break. But then this is a spectrum. And I think there is a third way, but I'm leaving that aside for now. Say that these are the two ways, and then there's a spectrum between the two, which is when it's more than a trickle. It doesn't completely destroy us. We don't have a total breakdown, but it's more than a trickle, and we can't actually incorporate it into the structures. We can't build a structure around it or upon it, at least not easily anyway. And so we have to really radically alter our ideas about reality. And this would be the case with Whitley and his aliens. This is more than a trickle, but at the same time it didn't completely blow the doors off his perception and leave him a basket case and or enlightened. So instead he restructured his map. He redesigned his map to include these beings called the visitors, and he spent the rest of his life since that time trying to, well, A, persuade the world that it's real, and B, find a way to interpret that experience that will be, that it can be incorporated into this consensus reality so that others will agree, oh yes, Whitley, this is real.
Yeah.
So that's the alien, I think. The alien is, not that the alien is coming from reality with a capital R, or even a higher reality or greater reality, but it's coming from another reality tunnel. It's coming into this reality tunnel, and it's, you know, causing a hole between the two tunnels, whereby it seems possible to fuse them, to create a bridge, like an actual, you know, two-way communication between these two tunnels. And that, I don't know, that seems like that's desirable, that's progress, that's expanding the paradigm. I would question that. I would question if that's really the point or the purpose of experiences like Sriva's, is to expand our view of reality as opposed to dismantling it completely.
Yeah. I think on almost that it isn't that. On a certain level, it's more like just a form of communication. You know, like Whitley invaded, you know, alien space and invaded Whitley,
mm-hmm.
kind of thing. So it's just a basic sort of communication, you know. Just like basic displacement, throwing a rock into the water. The rock goes into the water and the water jumps up out of the lake.
But that doesn't usually happen, does it?
What doesn't, sorry?
The rock doesn't jump out of the lake.
No, but the water jumps out of the lake.
Oh, the water does. Didn't you say rock?
Maybe I did. But,
maybe
I'm... But yeah, I mean, it's a poor metaphor anyway. But I just think it's almost not something as deep as a species trying to enlighten us or anything. I think it's just a basic, you know, configuration, basic communication.
Between what and what, though?
Well, it's just, you know, So like with when we went into space, Earth invaded space in the form of a rocket with astronauts on it. Earth invaded space, and then space, the idea of space by science fiction and so forth, that invaded us. It's an exchange.
Mm-hmm.
And
so that's we make this move into penetrate the outer world, outer space, and in return, and it's again questionable which came first because sci-fi predated space travel. But anyway, as part of that exchange, our inner world was penetrated by the idea of space.
Yes. Yeah.
That makes sense.
Yeah. Yeah, definitely. But it's just that we tend to pin a motive onto it. And it could be that we just knocked on the alien's door, and the alien is just basically sticking its head, opening its door and saying, yeah, what do you want, kind of thing.
Yeah. But what's the alien? Right.
I mean, it's a lot of things. I mean, I often think of it in terms of energy. Like, I look at a certain piece of artwork and I think, right, there's some alien energy in this. There's something that feels outside of what I know, what I recognise as earthly.
Right.
So, you know, some of Strieber's ideas, some of the stuff in The Key, you know, there's little hints of alien energy.
Mm-hmm. Have you heard Castaneda?
Yeah.
Would you say
Castaneda was a weird... Yeah, The Art of Dreaming.
Mm-hmm.
I read that one, and I had some real strange experiences after that. And yeah, and it's that feeling of alien energy. I didn't see any beings, I didn't see any inorganic beings or anything, but in my dreams I did feel like there was a certain invasion of this alien sort of reality.
Have you had any visitation experiences at all?
Yeah, I mean, the main thing was in 2009 I saw several UFOs within the space of like 6 weeks. One of them was witnessed by a friend, but the first one was incredible. it was... It's like 8 o'clock at night, and I just saw this ship floating over, like a diamond shaped ship. And it was 8 o'clock. It was sunny, and I saw this thing, and it blew my mind. And I was really excited and wanted to tell everyone, and everyone was just like, "Yeah, whatever."
Right.
But again, that experience changed me.
Mm-hmm.
Definitely, it felt like. My mind in the following weeks was trying to make room for this thing. It couldn't work out what it was, so my brain had to rearrange, probably like Strieber's did. But and the other thing was just a dream. It sounds pretty similar to some of the stuff that other people mentioned on these podcasts, but. Yeah, I was young in the dream, and this happened a fair few years ago, but I was actually a boy in this dream, and in the woods, and I saw that the aliens kind of hung back. I think they didn't want to frighten me, kind of thing. But anyway, they came out, and they did a holographic projection of a cartoon Jesus.
Hmm.
And this cartoon Jesus had stigmata, and like cartoon blood was spurting out. It's like from in a cartoon, you know, big red blobs of blood, but Jesus was smiling. This cartoon holographic Jesus was smiling at me, and And I took it to mean that the aliens were trying to trying to give me the idea that they offered an unconditional Christ-like love for the whole thing. It was very strange, and I remember, yeah, kind of laughing at it, and then they got rid of the holographic Jesus and then just gave me this kind of crystal energy ball. Just passed it to me and went, alright, thanks, bye. And that was it. That was the extent of it. So they never talked to me or anything.
What kind of aliens were they? Or beings, I should say.
They were kind of similar to the grey, but they were taller than what usually gets mentioned.
Mm.
They usually say that they're quite small, you know, 4 feet, 5 feet or something. But these were like 6 feet tall. And they had a weird sort of thing. It's like they faded in and out of reality. They're like when you see it on Star Trek, when beaming up Scotty, and they slowly kind of fade away from reality and then fade back in on the Enterprise.
Yeah.
It was like that, but that was while they were walking and kept on dissolving and reconfiguring and with lots of strange psychedelic colours.
Mm.
But I mean, it was just a dream. I didn't have any.
You didn't have any scoop marks when you woke up? Or?
No scoop marks, no implants that I'm aware of. I mean, it easily could have just been my, you know, dreaming self just created that little experience for me. But
are you familiar? Are you familiar with Jeremy Vaney? That's how you pronounce it.
No.
Okay, well, it's Paratopia. He's associated with Carol Rainey, Bud Hopkins, ex-wife, and I was listening to him recently, and he was describing he's an experiencer, and he was describing a visitation. I think he only had it happen once, but anyway, he woke up, or he was in his bed, and the beings were at the end of the bed, and he said that it was absolutely physically real, and he could see, you know, the clothing that they were wearing in detail, and that it was to the extent that now when he sees, you know, representations of these beings or, you know, simulations of them through CGI or what have you, he can say immediately, no, that's not right, they got that wrong. Like it, you know,
all right.
It was that concrete, his vision of it and his experience. And I had a sort of ambivalent response to that because, I mean, I've had all of my experiences of these visitations have been either while dreaming or while awake, but non-visual. Like I've had my eyes closed, and there was never even an option to open my eyes because it was so overwhelming, the sense of this presence with my eyes closed, much less. There was no way I wanted to actually open my eyes and look.
Oh, really?
Yeah, really.
Just from the terror of it?
Well, yes, I didn't want to use that word, but that is the word. It was absolute terror, and similar to what Vaney said, is his experience. He said he felt that there was like a barrier of terror between us and this other realm of consciousness or realm of being, whatever it is that we need to break through, get past. But that he also said that it seemed to have nothing to do with what they were communicating to him. That's why he felt the terror was this barrier within himself. And that was true also of my experience. The terror was purely physical. There was no mental terror. There was no like, oh my God, what's happening or what's it going to do, or incomprehension or confusion. It was like I knew what it was in some sense, not intellectually, but like there was a recognition or familiarity. And the terror wasn't connected to any thoughts or even feelings. It was just this absolute energy, this energy of terror. Anyway.
So it wasn't based on fear of their physical appearance being scary?
No, and it wasn't based on them doing anything, or it was one being, and I think it was female, and no, I felt this intimacy with it. I felt like, you know, Strieber describes in communion, I felt like this soul level intimacy with the being, like it was my ancient soulmate or something, not exactly that, but or even the holy guardian angel in the terms of the occult, not that I had that thought even afterwards, but now I'm just trying to sort of encapsulate the feeling of this being that was almost like my keeper or my caregiver or something, but a cosmic caregiver in some way. So the opposite of hostility or you know, malice seemed to be emanating from the being, and the terror was coming from inside of myself. And so it was an energy, it wasn't an emotion, it was an energy of terror. But anyway, that was kind of on a way to another point, which was that beside that, the other experiences I've had were in dreams, and even there, like even in the dreams, I often had my eyes closed and didn't want to see, and it was often as not, in recently I've had this experience, it was that I would sense their presence before they actually materialized, and the terror would begin. So it was the equivalent of like, if I open my eyes, I'm going to see them, like some part of me was being invited to have a full engagement with this energy or these beings, but the terror was so intense that even though I'd wanted it beforehand, now that it was close enough to experience it, really just like I would do anything to escape this encounter, just so utterly annihilatingly frightening. So even in dreams I tended to avoid the full encounter and not get a visual reading. But I did have one dream experience during the heaviest period of my life, in my late 20s, when I was having a lot of these dreams and encounters of actually encountering grey beings, and there were loads of them, and they had penises that came out of their bodies like snail horns, so they could disappear and appear, and they were kind of all over me. It was like an orgy, me the only human there, and the physical sensation of them was clammy and really repugnant to me. And I don't know if I was communicated this or I just intuited it during or after, but I came away anyway with the sense that I had wanted to have an experience of this energy more or less in the form that it's assuming for humanity collectively as the greys, quote unquote, just to try that out. And it was horrific. It wasn't the clean, clear terror of the other encounters, or almost encounters, which was just something in me. There was also this repulsion. And so I understood then why I thought I understood, I don't know now what to think of it, but why I chose at some level not to experience this energy in a strictly local, physical way, and then not to allow it to become fully clothed in you know, the components of this reality. So then when I heard Vaini's thing, I thought, well, you know, is that really real? You know, is that, you know, how much is that a kind of submitting to something, or an imposing upon something? It's a bit of a paradox. But how much does that fixed reality really, is it really a result of, in a way, an unwillingness to just let the thing be what it is, which is totally unknown?
Yeah. I don't know. But what would the alternative be? You know, just like willingly sort of, you know, giving some semen for the aliens or something.
Well, no, that's what ends up when you impose upon and allow it to impose upon us this fixed reality, and it ends up sticking implements in us and extracting our fluids, and it becomes like how it has to take some form that metaphorically represents its relationship with us in a way that is, we can consensually agree this is really happening. Look, I've got the scars, I've got the tissue damage, I've got the, you know, all the rest of it, the concrete evidence of it. The alternative is the opposite of that, is to allow that element to enter into our structured interpretation of reality without turning it into a component of it, and that means that that whole structure comes unraveled, I think, and that's the terror, and that's my guess. You know, in Castaneda, he talks about how the sorcerer's view is the dead end, because its only function is to give to a person an alternate interpretation of reality with which to juxtapose our ordinary interpretation. And when you put the two side by side, they cancel each other out, because you see that the sorcerer's interpretation of reality is as real and is as all-inclusive as our previous interpretation. And so there's a moment of recognition now where this is just an interpretation. The sorcerer's view of reality isn't real, but neither is the interpretation that I've replaced it with. Neither are real. They're both interpretations. And I think the alien, so-called, is the same thing. I think it's a interpretation of reality with which to juxtapose our previous interpretation so that the two collide and cancel each other out. We weasel between the two, and Castaneda's terms, you weasel between the two, between the crack. So you don't go from one reality tunnel to the other. You realize you're in a tunnel and you leave the tunnel.
Right. Yeah. I think there's a middle way, though. From, you know, purely leaving this tunnel or just being stuck in a reality tunnel. And that middle way is what interests me. As in, I mean, I had like these dreams, stroke visions, stroke daydreams, or whatever, of a basically an alien planet, where where society was built around manifestation, and it's almost, for instance, I went to this stadium where there was kind of some alien art display or something, but we all had these little trays beside us, and if we concentrated, we could manifest our drinks.
Mm-hmm.
So rather than everything being, you know, like in a lucid dream, everything's instantly manifested, you have these specific spaces where manifestation is more likely to occur. So it's like slightly above our reality, but yeah, it's like a stepping stone between this reality and the all-encompassing lucid, you know, creation reality or whatever it is that would completely destroy our reality tunnel.
Yeah.
And I think that kind of gets passed over. You know, you just... I think there's stepping stones between, you know, earthly reality and the abyss or dream time.
I think that's true. I wrote about a matrix, sorry, a transitional matrix. People aren't ready to actually be unplugged, so they need to go into these in-between worlds where they're semi-unplugged, where reality isn't as fixed, before they let the reality come completely unraveled. And I think it's natural that we do that it's like the Bardo realms, though, as well. Like after death, if we're not ready to, for the infinite, we'll enter into this surrogate reality that's generated from our own memories and thoughts and desires, and potentially get lost in there. So I think that that's the danger in what you're positing. I think that it's natural that we create these transitional states, but I think it's also natural we get lost in them.
No, I mean, I think that's why it's there as a learning tool. So, you know, if this idea of, you know, instant manifestation, which gets bandied around a lot, especially in New Age circles, if the average person was to find themselves in a realm where any thought was instantly manifested, they'd create a monster that would, you know, chase after them, or they'd create a load of beautiful girls and have sex until they, you know, there was nothing left of themselves. So what I'm interested in is the stepping stone reality, the reality that, you know, helps us learn how to manifest and how to do it sensibly.
So, but is manifestation, is it really the bee's knees? I mean, is that what it's all about, like learning to manifest?
No, but it is the bee's knees. It is pretty good.
Yeah. Oh, but isn't that back to what we're talking about, the transhumanists and trying to create a playground in which we can gratify every desire? I mean, what's the big deal about manifesting?
Well, no, it becomes... I mean, it's not just about creating the individual's desires. It's about creating a world for the mass of people, you know, that co-creation aspect.
Well, landed on the terrace. I shouldn't use the possessive article there, but he's on the verge of domestication. Like, he's getting very bold, and he'll, when he sees me, he'll come land right nearby and just say, "Where's the peanuts?" Not literally, although here ravens can speak. Yeah, so that's kind of a time example, because you could say I manifested that, but all I did was, you know, leave some peanuts out. I noticed the raven, and so I'm having this relationship with the raven, and it's definitely one of the high points of my reality at this time. But I'm not using any magical tools or anything. I'm just responding to what's there.
Yeah. But that's a specific kind of manifestation, and that kind of manifestation, I'm sort of a bit just blasé about, really.
What?
Like, you know, when you see, you know, have a meeting with an animal, you know, synchronous kind of things that occur.
Well, it's not the same as synchronicity, because that is more mystical. I'm just about actually having a relationship with our environment and tuning into other consciousnesses in our environment and how one's life becomes transformed by that without having to manifest anything.
Yeah. But either way, whatever it is, I just... I'm not as interested in it, because the things that you can't change, like, at the moment, I can't change this grey England sky and these dull terrace houses that I'm surrounded by.
Yeah.
So this, you know, and probably most of the people on this street are also, you know, not that enamoured by the surroundings, and So if we were to be able to learn conscious
co-creation... Hold on, I mean, you could move to Mexico. It doesn't require psychic abilities to change your environment.
Well, it depends. If you want luminous green skies, then it would.
Why would you? I mean, this is like the universe has been working on its design for billions of years, and suddenly we think we can improve upon it. I don't get that.
Well, because we're surrounded by colour now. You know, if I'm playing my video games, reading comics, etc., you know, I've had the idea of a vividly coloured reality planted in my head. And I like that idea.
Uh-huh. So then you're a victim of... Your inner space has been invaded and now you want to correct the balance or repay the favour.
No, because I almost think it's... Actually, I'm going to go back on what I said, that the idea of vivid colours being planted in my head. Because maybe it has to an extent, but I just think ever since I was young, my dreams, the what I'm attracted to is always these vivid colours. So...
Sure. Well, the inner reality is a vibrant field of colour, and I agree it's nice if our outer reality reflects that, but I don't think it's necessary. I think it's sort of inevitable while being unnecessary, because it's unnecessary to us, it happens naturally, but the more we tune into that vibrancy of our inner world, which is infinite, the more our outer world is transformed by that seeing, because then when we would notice the colour in the grey or the crows in the car park or whatever else it is, our attention would just naturally start moving towards what is vibrant in colour, and we wouldn't then have to transform the world into, you know, Charlie's Chocolate Factory or Willy Wonka's Chocolate Factory.
See, I'd like that. I'd love to live in, you know, Willy Wonka's Chocolate
Well, I'm getting that. I'm getting that from you. And it's quite good because I said, well, I need to have someone to talk to on this project that is in favour of these things that I'm criticising. And so, but you've, initially you said you distrust transhumanism, but now you seem to be actually presenting the case for it, I would say, perhaps unwittingly.
Yeah, no, No, I think I am, in a lot of ways, pro a lot of the ideas in transhumanism, but not completely at all. And I think it's very short-sighted in many ways, like the Turing test that we mentioned earlier.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Well,
but certain ideas, as in the idea of transcending the current human situation that I am involved in, I'm very pro.
And would you say that that's a direct result of being personally dissatisfied?
In some ways, yes, but in other ways, it's just, you know, it's a feeling, you know, and sometimes it's to do with morals as well, you know.
What are they? Enlightening. Well, like, thou shalt not kill, stuff like that.
Yeah. thou shalt not be drunk and shout at people randomly when you're walking around your local town. Just that kind of thing.
Well, okay, so yeah, I mean, of course, it's natural to want to live in, and if necessary, co-create an environment in which one is comfortable and feels in harmony. That's just a natural instinctive thing, but it doesn't require changing the world, and it certainly doesn't require like transforming reality, in my opinion. It just requires moving to a nice place. Okay, there's income. I know we do live in a society that basically is trying to turn us into human batteries and all of that. I don't want to downplay the fact that we do appear to be overrun by some sort of malign intelligence. But what is it? I mean, the malign intelligence is only overrun us, I think, to the extent that it's infiltrated us, our biosystems, and taken over our hardware. So, I mean, this has been my position for a long time now, so I don't want to just be banging on about it too much, yeah. But Einstein said it, we can't change the world with this, we can't solve problems that have been created with the same thinking that has created those problems.
No, definitely not. So, and that's why I'm interested in learning manifestation, really. Even the implications.
But isn't that like the secret, really? That's what the secret's all about.
No, I mean, I guess, I've not read it, to be honest. I just know vaguely that it was, you know, Oprah Winfrey liked it.
Yeah, well, you said just a while ago about, you know, people manifesting their perfect Ferraris and stuff.
Yeah.
In the context of spiritual self-realization.
Yeah.
So I don't see a clear dividing line between being rich and attractive and famous through psychic power, or whatever you want to call the secret stuff is, and creating a perfect world where everyone can live happily ever after. I don't see where that line is that divides what is basically a narcissistic agenda with a supposedly moral.
I don't think so. I think if you think of it in terms of study, you know, if you're serious about learning, you know, any of this esoteric kind of stuff, you can't do it in any academic way, really. There's no course that really supports that.
Well, I'm not sure that's true. I know someone who's doing a PhD in channeling right now.
Okay. I don't think it's on the syllabus of most universities, anyway.
Manifestation.
Yeah. Well, but, the concept of university, you know, that kind of supposes you've got 3 years of pure study time,
yeah.
And anything else you have to do when you're not working. So in that sense, our current reality doesn't support certain forms of study.
So well,
that's what I'm on about.
Bring it back to sort of more basic question, right? I guess my sense is that, and this brings it to transhumanism, that if we turned our world into a kind of snare, kind of a trap for ego gratification because of these infantile, unmet infantile needs, it's a big if, I admit, but
yeah.
Then the more that we manage to transform our reality and improve it, whether it's through technology or through esoteric practices or anything, the more of a trap it's going to be. The more we gild the bars of our cage.
Yes, if we go about this transformative, transhumanist change without, you know, due care or due knowledge, then yeah, it's that's what's going
to
happen.
Well, I don't think due care and due knowledge is enough to counteract the force of the unconscious stuff.
Right. No, I don't. And so I guess that's something that needs to be addressed, really.
So, I mean,
the unconscious.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, that's always the nub of things is, well, until we have addressed the question of the unconscious and, well, theoretically, potentially made it conscious, we can't really begin to separate those unconscious drives and those patterns, which are really pathological if they're given into, they become pathological, from a higher aspiration to connect to the source and become an embodiment of the real, which is the only kind of fulfillment that's going to work. I mean, just logically speaking. Well, maybe it's not logical. I don't know. In Castaneda's thing, again, or it's sort of adopted from Castaneda, but I think it was that Mares, that Toltec writer, he said that there was two kinds of seers, those who, or sorcerers, those who seek total freedom and those who take the path of high adventure. And so there are those who, like Jesus said, my Father's house has many mansions. So he said that this physical reality, is this universe, multiverse, is this house with many mansions in it, mansion with many rooms, this almost infinitude of tunnels, reality tunnels, and either we choose, well, assuming we're willing to take the steps to leave our own reality tunnel, either we choose to leave the whole honeycomb of tunnels, of illusory realities completely, or we choose to enjoy just exploring all of the tunnels. And
yeah, so are you not keen on the idea of exploring the tunnels?
I am, Castaneda, but...
Castaneda seemed to be about exploring the tunnels.
I think that that's probably true, even though he probably didn't know it, and so maybe that's the question. Like, if you make a conscious, if it's a really fully conscious choice, say, look, I can be totally free now, but I... what's the point? Because I'll just return to the infinite nothingness of nothing infinite, of whatever, you know, whatever that is. So I'm gonna, you know, I'm gonna stay and manifest. But I don't think that that was a conscious choice on Castaneda's part. I think Castaneda ended up going insane. So my sense is that, maybe I feel like I've done it for too long, like I've just been going in and out of these tunnels for lifetime after lifetime, and I think it's all about, again, the transhumanist thing of desire for immortality. You brought this a great word I'd never heard of, aperiphobia, fear of the infinite. I think that if you're willing, if you're able, and that's a big if, to actually embrace the infinite and be dissolved into the infinite, then there is no substitute for that. And so, but so I can't help but think that a desire for high adventure and to stay in the tunnels is always going to be driven by fear of the infinite somehow. And I'm not comfortable with that. Like, I don't want fear to be what's actually determining my choices, I suppose.
Yeah.
Doesn't mean it won't, of course. But it's interesting that this whole subject of infinity and that phrase that you... I think it's a great phrase, because, like, who the hell isn't afraid of the infinite? Like, how can you not be afraid of it? Doesn't seem like a phobia. It just seems like a part, you know, an aspect of reality. But Strieber's thing of the prisoner of infinity... is a weird sort of contradiction, because infinity is the opposite of a prison. No?
Mm.
Like, a prison is what confines you, and infinity is a total absence.
Yeah.
Confinement.
I mean, I sort of don't understand the fear in a way, because so from Whitley's point of view, he's had contact from these other realities or other reality, and he seems to believe in, you know, parallel universes or the multiverse.
Yeah.
So why he sees the aliens as being prisoners of infinity rather than, you know, these beings who can explore infinite reality?
Mm-hmm.
I can't get my head around it. How a being would feel imprisoned by it.
Well, if you imagine, and this is how I get my head around it, if you imagine a transhumanist goal were possible, it were possible to actually extend the ego into the infinite, or to project it into the infinite. So, in other words, we could become eternal while at the same time be identified with a specific set of memories. It would be like the undead, right? It would be like the Nosferatu. It would be the curse of curses.
Yeah, but I don't think, for certain reasons, and I don't have any concrete information as to why I don't believe it could happen, but I think things like time dilation, you know, if you're used to living, you know, hundreds of centuries, that would become the new norm, and centuries would fly by like minutes do to us.
Yeah, fine, but eternity isn't a long period of time. That's the thing. That's the misnomer, the miscomprehension of eternity. This is infinity, isn't a very, very large space.
Well, it could never... it could never be eternity, because the being that now had immortality would have had a start point. So it could only go forward into infinity. It couldn't go back in time, back into infinity. So it still wouldn't be infinity, because the infinite goes in all directions.
Right.
Whereas this would have a start point.
Right, exactly. So eternity and infinity are not, they're non-linear. Because a line that has no beginning or end is not a line.
Yeah, that's right, yeah. And in a way, we do sort of live backwards, in the sense that we're always, you know, looking back to when we were kids, or, you know, the mother fixation or whatever.
Yeah.
So in a sense, we...
Yeah. Sorry, I didn't mean to cut you off there.
Oh, no problem.
Did I cut you off?
Yeah, I was just saying that in the sense that we kind of do live backwards as well as live forwards. That we're mapping the past at the same time as venturing into the future. So,
yeah. Well, I'm not sure I quite comprehend that, but I was going to interrupt you anyway with having had an experience of eternal damnation, right? Like an experience of the eternal while in my ego, let's say, and that was damnation. There is no eternity for the ego besides damnation. I don't believe there is that either. I don't believe in damnation, but I do believe, I do have experience that, like, the ego will, as with the aliens, it will pull anything and everything into the box of its constructed reality, and then reinterpret it so that it can become part of it. Now, you can do that with aliens, you can do that with sorcerers, you can do that with, you know, dead spirits, whatever else it is, and unidentifiable energies. We'll find a way to interpret them and translate them into something that can be incorporated into our ego structures. So if you do that, but if you do that with the infinite, what happens is that you are imprisoning the infinite in the ego, so to speak. Not that the infinite experiences itself being imprisoned, but that we experience that infinite part of ourselves, which is a bit of a oxymoron, an infinite part. But anyway, our infinite nature is experienced through the ego, as therefore being confined by the ego, and so that is damnation. The ego itself is damnation, and so the temporary, of course, because ego, you know, well, maybe doesn't die with the body, but it's certainly not immortal. So it's kind of the reverse of Strieber's thing and the prisoner of the infinity concept, because it's not the prisoner of infinity; it's infinity that is the prisoner.
Yeah. It still seems like opportunity to me. If it's true infinity, right, that means access to infinite amount of universes, and you could be an infinite amount of beings.
Sure.
Simultaneously. Yeah, in some cases, or in some cases you could pick and choose, you know.
But you already are. That's the thing. That's the point, isn't it? Because if you, Mr. Panda, Jonathan,
yeah,
can, are capable of experiencing a consciousness parceled out or multiplied into these infinite realms, well, then you are doing that. And, you know, maybe one of those realms is me, like my life. And so it's like you've chosen to put all of your attention on this one particular package of information that is your life.
Yeah.
So that's, I won't say that's the choice you made, but because who knows what choices, but that's what you're experiencing now. So,
well,
I mean, that's got to be enough, is what I'm saying. That's, because if it wasn't enough, you would have chosen, you would be experiencing more. So I could just witness, I'm sorry. It's the will of God that this is your life. And I guess that's kind of partly what I'm saying, but it's more to that, more to it than that. It's just that, I mean, reality is so vast, even from the point of view of just one little finite self, or especially, in fact, I mean, the more infinite you've become, the less vast reality would be in proportion. So I think it has to do with being overwhelmed by reality, which is the infant
yes.
experience, and so we want to somehow compensate for that by becoming as big and as powerful as reality.
Right. So I guess it could be the idea then that the visitors, if they feel trapped via infinity, that they want to go kind of the opposite way, the way humans are going, the way, you know, human history has opened us up to, you know, more levels of creation and greater gathering of intelligence. So perhaps they want to reduce, you know, become simpler.
Yeah, well, that's Strieber's theory. He says that because they are outside space-time, they know everything, and so there's no surprises, so they're going mad with boredom.
Right.
Now, I think he must be projecting somewhat there. But it's a poetic idea, and it's very resonant. I mean, it's even some people, some versions of the creationist, that God was lonely, and so he was going mad from boredom too, and so he created the universe. Now, this is all, we're humanizing, we're giving it a human, we're creating a human narrative around, you know, transcosmic events. So clearly they're very limited, and I guess that's kind of the point, really, isn't it? So long as we want to experience being human, we have to experience being finite and being limited and being mortal and being flawed and imperfect. But our experience of that is that we want to be more than that. So we're just kind of in this vicious circle of dissatisfaction and striving to transcend, but it's really
a
desire to transcend that we need to transcend, I think.
Possibly. I think it's more that we want to get to a point where we don't need to transcend, that we're at a place we feel comfortable with, and so it's not that we're at a place that we're happy at, basically.
Sure. I know. It does come down to that.
Yeah. But I do think that theory of the devolving alien is interesting. I've never thought about it in that way. And it kind of ties in with the way that they freely give their intelligence away or their technology away.
Yeah.
They actually want to get rid of it.
Huh.
You know, I don't know. But yeah, it's interesting.
Well, it's kind of overlaps with Atlantis and the mythos of Atlantis, which is that we evolved to such an extent that, you know, we became corrupt and or complacent and self-destructive or suicided or whatever happened, or maybe divine intervention. But whatever the case, yeah, we kind of
right. Yeah, the theory I had about Atlantis that I read, and I've not read a lot, was that they became extremely stratified as a society.
Yeah.
They divided the island up into two quadrants. So the left brain created types of being one part, and you know, and so forth. And the friction between the various parts of Atlantis caused the war or something. And yeah, when
vulcanization.
Yeah, and then the Martians were involved somehow.
Well, that.
Sorry, I'm speaking rubbish.
That's Whitley's thing. He brings the Martians in. That Earth went to war with the Martians. That's in the key.
Right.
So, I just see these all the stories, really. Like, even if they're not made up, then they are made up. Like, because it's all, everything's like Midas touch. The ego turns everything into fiction.
Yeah.
Yeah. Because the infinite can't be a protagonist in this story.
No, and it can only be a projection, really. I mean, like, I don't know what our narrative is. You know, if our time now that we're living in is going to be spun into, you know, some myth like Atlantis, I can't really imagine what form that would take, how it could transform into a story.
It would probably be the same story. It's probably always the same story.
Yeah.
Because it's finite, so then there's a finite number of components, they get rearranged, but the outcome's always the same, like the 100 monkeys typing Shakespeare. You know, eventually, the elements rearrange into the sort of inevitable, the inevitable story, which is the Lucifer, hubris, Frankenstein's monster story, I think.
Yeah.
That's our myth, isn't it? Prometheus.
It is, and yeah, it's another one of those things that I don't know, I just get these feelings of dissatisfaction with various myths that seem to repeat themselves, various symbols, and I just feel that we need kind of a fresh influx of information somehow.
I think so too. I think it's not so much the information that needs to be new, but the processing, like we need it. A new processing system, and maybe not a new one, but the original one, which is the body. I think the body is the original processing system or technology, and the mind has installed itself in the body, or the ego mind, the ego has installed itself in the body via the mind, or however the hell that worked, and so now the mind has taken over processing, and so the mind is finite. I guess because it has to compartmentalize, it has to turn everything into a story. Whereas if we were, the body receives information and receives experience moment to moment, and it doesn't weave a narrative out of it. I don't think it might store it, but it's stored like organically in the body, and so it's all. Coexisting simultaneously. It's not rendered into this linear narrative of I. I did this, I did that, and then I died. And then I was born again, and then I went to Mars, and then I became God, and then I fell from grace and became Satan, and then I created a multiverse, and then they all discovered technology and became immortal through technology, and then the aliens arrived, and then. I mean, it's great if it's a story, right? If you see it as a story, then the stories are for children, and it's great, but actual real living, I think, is not. I don't think it's a story, crazy as that seems.
Yeah, can you think of a metaphor to what it's like? I mean, like free jazz improvisation, or
I'm not a jazz aficionado, so that wouldn't be my first choice. But I think we have the metaphor, and that is that is existence, like physical existence, nature. That the universe is, that's my cat making a noise there, I have to communicate with it. The universe is, I mean, it's all this stuff is happening, and it's very dramatic. But you can't really turn the universe into a story because there's just way too many things happening. Like, I mean, it would be an understatement to say that you would go insane if you tried to sort the seeds of the universe and make them into a coherent narrative. Assuming you could actually gather all the data of everything that's happening in the universe and has happened since the beginning of time. I mean,
yeah,
that, in theory, that's a story, right? But it's not. I mean, really, it's not. It can't be. It can't be reduced to a linear narrative. Any more than, in fact, we don't even have to extend that far. If we think of every life on the earth and everyone who's ever lived and every incident and every thought that has occurred on this planet, to all the different individuals and animals and cells and rocks and trees and every breeze and every leaf that's fallen, the idea of somehow trying to map that and turn that into a coherent narrative is completely deranging.
It is.
Right?
But visualization, perhaps.
Well, that's the alternative, I think. We could actually, I think, in theory at least, we could experience all of those happenings. And so we could have that story, quote-unquote, unfold through us and as us. But it wouldn't be a linear narrative.
No.
It would be an event. It would be an event that is simultaneously instantaneous and eternal. Because it's the same
event.
Right? I mean, the existence happening is the same event, just because, you know, this person dies and this person is born and this building is built and this one gets knocked down by jumbo jets, it doesn't mean that it's not the same event. It's all the same event. Life.
Yeah, completely. So I guess it's a matter of picking and choosing, you know, the objects of focus. But if you were to have, I don't know, if you had like, I don't know, it'd be possible to get some sort of picture of a certain period of time. So say we, you know, you had like a 3D representation of the Earth from, say, you know, 1 AD up until the present day, and you had sort of a 3D hologram of the Earth, and every action on the Earth was condensed into 10 minutes, so 2,000 years and 10 minutes. And
you're
so
undaunted,
you can kind of experience it in that way.
You're undaunted by my presentation. I think theoretically, yeah, these things are possible, but I think there's an abyss between theory and practice, and this is the abyss that we're on the verge of falling into, plummeting into, and I think it's very evident with Strieber's, the contradictory nature of the material, and with transhumanism, that the theory is not the practice, and when we begin to try and practice the theory, we will discover that and be unprepared, probably, for how unprepared we are for the reality of the practice. When we meet the alien and discover it's us, it's not like, oh, hi, how you doing? You're me. That's nice to meet you. I'm glad to finally meet myself. It's not. It's screaming body terror. And if we succeed in translating ourselves into some digitalized form, to the extent that we actually survive that translation at all, which is probably zero, but if there is any kind of continuity of consciousness, we will probably find ourselves trapped in some kind of hideous machine subservience that is very much the closest we could get to simulate eternal damnation as viewed by, you know, Catholic pathology.
Yeah.
We're making our worst night.
That's a troubling, troubling notion. At least. But, yeah. And I think, yeah, a certain amount of people would do that. You know? They'd happily create their own crazy-ass damnation matrix.
Yeah, well, we may have done it already. We may be living it, even to a greater or lesser extent. Feel my head like spiders in the kitchen. Don't think twice.